Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46. When the Son of Man comes in the glory of His Father, with the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And He will set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the King will say to those on the right hand, "Come, you blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave Me food. I was thirsty, and you gave Me drink. I was a stranger, and you took Me in. I was naked, and you clothed Me. I was sick, and you visited Me. I was in prison, and you came to Me." Then the righteous will answer Him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" And the King will answer and say to them, "Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these My brethren, you did it to Me." Then He will also say to those on the left hand, "Depart from Me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave Me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave Me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take Me in. Naked, and you did not clothe Me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit Me." Then they also will answer Him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you?" Then He will answer them, saying, "Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to Me." And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into everlasting life, eternal life. I cannot think of any passage in the Bible that is more sobering than that passage that we just read. One thing for sure, as Jesus pictures for us the judgment scene, a scene where every one of us will be, where you will be, and where I will be, He obviously pictures that our actions or lack thereof to those who are truly in need will be a determining factor in where we will spend eternity. But in all ages, and I'm sure this was true back before I have any way of knowing what men were doing, people have the tendency to pass the buck, to say, "Well, I can't do this, let somebody else do it for me." First, there's the passing the buck from the individual to the church. "I can't do this, let the church do it for me." And then from the church to some institution begun by men. "We'll set up an institution for this reason, and we'll send a little bit of money off and satisfy our conscience, salve our conscience by this institution doing this for us." From almost the beginning of the Lord's church, this is how brethren have operated. I have a set of books in my library, and it's probably the best history of the church up through the time of the Reformation movement, the uninspired history that's ever been written, by Dr. Philip Schaff, who was one of the leading scholars in the Church of England in the latter part of the 19th century. It's an 8-volume history, and each volume is about 1,000 pages. And so it's a big tome of a thing. Professor Schaff has this to say concerning what was going on in the early church, and this is a direct quote: "In primitive times, every case of poverty or suffering was separately brought to the notice of the bishop." Now notice, he's talking about a time that began in the 2nd century, by the way, in which in the local church they had passed from having a group of men, two or more, who were called elders or bishops, to a time when there was one man over the church. And that one man was called the bishop in distinction from the elders. Now that distinction is not made in the New Testament. That's the same office in the New Testament. So he's talking about from the second century and on. But he says, the notice of the bishop and personally relieved by a deacon. So this was the arrangement in the local church, as he says, in primitive times. Now this goes back to the second century, but this is also what was true except for that one bishop in the first century, that if there was a need in the local church for benevolence, for relief of the needy brethren, then being brought to the attention of the elders of the church, then this was a work that a deacon would do in seeing that this need was met. Afterwards, notice, institutions were founded for widows and orphans, poor and infirm, and generally placed under the superintendence of the bishop. Now, the difference in modern times is this generally is placed under the supervision of a board of directors. But personal responsibility, now here's what I want us to get. Personal responsibility was diminished by this organized charity, and the deacons lost their original significance and became subordinate officers of public worship. And you see what's happening here? There is a transfer of responsibility. There are some responsibilities that we have as individuals that we cannot pass on to anyone else. I have two passages here, and we're going to notice one of these later on. If we have time, we'll notice the second as well, that apply to individual Christians, that show in individual obligations that we have. And of course, you know that in the first century, Jesus charged the Jewish rulers with saying, "Let it be korban." That means, this is Mark 7, 9-13, that is a gift. By whatever you would be prospered. And they would not even meet their own responsibilities to their own parents, but pass this off to the Jewish leaders to take care of for them. And they just, as far as any individual obligation, they would let their parents starve rather than fulfill the obligation given by the Old Testament to honor your father and your mother, an obligation which is repeated in the New Testament. And so there's the passing on of personal responsibility, a responsibility that we do not have the right to pass on to anybody else, to another group. And in modern times, this is passed on to the local church. Well, the local church has elders, is made up of elders and deacons and saints. And what's happening in local churches? Well, oftentimes, what is a legitimate obligation of the local church? Now, sometimes they take on obligations which are not the legitimate concern or obligation of the local church as a group, but rather should be taken care of by individuals. And they pass that on to some distant, benevolent organization under a board of directors and say, "Well, we're taking care of this by sending off a little bit of money." Thus, there's the passing of the buck from the individual to the church and from the church to some distant benevolent organization organized with no higher authority than the authority of the state. Now then, we've said all that to say, we want to look at our individual obligations. The Lord willing, I'll do this morning and again next Sunday morning, talking about our individual obligations in the benevolent realm that we cannot pass on to somebody else. These are our own individual obligations as Christians. What are our obligations as individuals? This in distinction to what the church does, and certainly in distinction to some distant organization. What are our obligations as individuals to help the needy? Well, the first thing we've already seen is that helping the needy, according to the text that we took for this lesson, Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, is an important part of our obligation to Jesus Christ and of following Jesus Christ. That even as our Master was concerned for the unfortunate, we must be concerned for those who are in need, and we have individual obligations to help them. And when we stand before the Lord on the day of judgment, that will be a basis upon which we shall be judged, whether or not we have fed those who are hungry. and given drink to those who are thirsty, whether we have taken in those who are strangers, whether we have clothed those who are naked, whether we have visited those who are sick. And by the way, the word visit does not mean to go by and say hello. It means to go to see them with the purpose of relieving their needs. And not only is this the definition of the word, but later in the passage, which we've already read, you remember when those who were cursed said, "When did we see you in these conditions and did not minister to you?" And that word summarizes all that Jesus has in mind. Here the word minister means to serve. And so it means to go by to see those who are sick with the purpose of helping them, serving them, not just to say hello, hope you get feeling better. And also, of course, those who are in prison, those who are suffering for the sake of the Lord, those suffering because they're Christians, those are benevolent obligations that we as individuals have. We cannot pass the buck on these things, and we will stand before the Lord in judgment and either receive eternal life or eternal condemnation based on what each of us individually has done in this work of relieving those who are in need. But that's not the only passage. There's many passages in the New Testament that show us the obligations we have. Look at Acts chapter 20, verse 35. In Acts chapter 20, the Apostle Paul has called the elders of the church at Ephesus to meet him, and he is going over with them the work that he did among them as an example for them of what the work of a preacher is and also of what we as Christians ought to be. And he relates what he had done in Ephesus for the 3 years plus that he worked there as a preacher. And he was not a lazy preacher. He even worked physically with his hands to help provide his own needs. And he says, "I have shown you in every way, by laboring like this, that you must support the weak. And remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he said, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" And years ago, my family and I lived down in Mena in southwest Arkansas, and there was a little sandwich shop there that my family loved to go because you could get whatever size sandwich you wanted and whatever kind of meat you wanted. My kids particularly loved it because they would get something like that. But we would love to, and it had all kinds of funny sayings on the wall. You know, put up little plaques on the wall. And one of their sayings was, "It is more blessed to give than to receive, but receiving is good enough for me." Well, it better not be. Because you remember what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 25? If we are those who only receive but do not give, we're going to be on that side that says, "Depart from me, you cursed, into an everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels." No, receiving had better not be good enough for any of us. We as Christians have taken upon ourselves to walk in the steps of the Master. And He was the one who came to give, not to receive. And we also must be those who are giving, not just receiving. Sometimes when I was up in the North Country, as Northern New York is called, and we had military families there, and some of them had learned, particularly have in mind one young woman who her husband was a sergeant. In fact, he was E-8. And so she had, as the wife of an E-8, she had all kinds of responsibilities that were hers, and she had learned about these young couples that were takers and not givers, and she would warn about that. You know, there's some people that all they want to do is take and they never give anything, and we had some people like that in the congregation, and that particularly miffed her because she had been taught, correctly so, as an army wife, that she was to be a giver, not just a taker. And that is true, certainly, of us as Christians. I appreciate the wonderful things that many of you have done. I appreciate that Lynn still refers to me as our new preacher. and that means the honeymoon's still on. I like that. But I appreciate the many wonderful things that members of this congregation have done for us. And we also, not just because I'm the preacher, but because I call myself a Christian, we also must be doing what we can do to try to help those who are less fortunate. hearts of us. And obviously, now I'm not trying to get onto the congregation. Most of the members of this congregation are a good example of what we ought to do. I'm trying to encourage us to continue in these things. Joe has read before us this morning a list of the people that we know of in the congregation have special needs because of sick in the family or other problems that we're having. And every member of this congregation should be concerned about that and be doing what we can to alleviate and to help those in those needs. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good. Now, if we stop right there, that's a good passage, isn't it? Because anybody that's stealing, there's various ways of stealing. You could take a gun and go rob a convenience store, or you could be selling something and beat somebody out of that and actually steal their money and break no law. Maybe sell them something that's no good or sell them something that you know is not worth anything like that. And there's lots of ways that you can steal, but Paul said, you stop that. You're a Christian now. You're walking in the steps of the Master. You're giving and not just receiving. You're loving others. You want to treat others the way you want to be treated yourself. So you quit that stealing and you get to busy and work with your hands. Now that'd be good enough as it is, isn't it? But no, he goes, why should we work with our hands? That he may have something to give to him who has need. One of the big reasons that we should work honest toil in order to make a living is that we might be able to help those who are less fortunate than us. And so this is an obligation that comes upon us as Jesus came to this world to give, not just to receive. And thus we should also, walking in His footsteps, be those who are giving. We also need to recognize, second great principle of the lesson, that there is a difference between our obligation as individuals and the obligation or the work of the local church as a group, as sometimes we say a collectivity, that is a collective body of people that works collectively. When we go to American Samoa, there are some people there that have given us problems in our work, and they say there's no difference between the individual and the church. Whatever the individual can do, the church can do. Well, the Apostle Paul didn't know that. And the Apostle Paul was obviously an inspired apostle of Christ. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16, he draws a clear line of distinction between our individual obligations and the obligation of the local church. And this is a line which must not be crossed. If any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows. The really are, as the old King James says, and I really prefer the old King James here, it says, widows indeed. And those are widows indeed, the really widows. They're described in verses 3 through 16 of 1 Timothy chapter 5. And that's a group of women that could be enrolled by the local church to be permanently relieved, to be permanently supported by the local church. But they're the only ones that can. And others have an obligation to relieve their own needy. Here's a believing man or woman. And they have a widow who is kin to them. What's their obligation? They must take care of that widow who is kin to them. And what about the local church? Can the local church relieve that needy widow? I've used this illustration before. I'll use it again. I lived in northern New York for several years while my mother was a widow. And she was a member of a congregation in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And just suppose that my mother were in need and she was called to say, Keith, you know, I just can't even pay to have groceries. You need to help me out. And I said, well, Mother, you need to talk to the church there at Burns Park where you're a member. Let them help you out. Now, if you'd find out that about me, would you want me to be your new preacher? I hope not. Now, I hope that you would say, Matt, that man is worse than an unbeliever. Even unbelievers out in the world know you're supposed to help your own parents out. And particularly if your mother's a widow and too old to work, why, of all things, to let her have to go to the church and get help from the church when you have something you could help her, why, that's just a that's awful for somebody to do that, isn't it? It's acting worse than people out in the world act toward their own parents. And so, no, my mother was my obligation, not the church's. I could not pass her off and say, well, just let the church take care of her. But the church may relieve those who are really widows. So there is a clear distinction made in the New Testament. By the way, this is not the only passage that does it, but it's the only passage we need because it clearly does it. There's a clear distinction made in the New Testament between our individual obligations to do the work of benevolence, helping those who are in need, and the obligations of the local church, and we must not cross that line. The church is not to take on obligations, other individual obligations, and individuals not to pass their obligations off to the church. That line must not be crossed. Now, what are our obligations as individuals to help the needy? Well, we should, number one, when we help those who are needy, we should expect nothing in return. There was a lady that I knew who was willing to help out another lady in the congregation. This was in northern New York, where we used to be. But she wanted to give her a loan and for the lady to repay the loan. Well, that's if you want to make a loan to somebody, then that's a business arrangement that you make. That's your business. But notice, please, that that's a business arrangement. That's not benevolence. If we're doing something to help those who are needy, then so far as carnal or material things, we should expect nothing in return. In Luke chapter 6, verses 33 through 35, and this, by the way, is parallel to the Sermon on the Mount, which is found in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. But it's not the same sermon. If you look going back to the beginning of Luke chapter 6, this was a sermon that Jesus preached to both disciples and the general population in a plain at the foot of the mount. The Sermon on the Mount was preached to his disciples on the mount. So there's two different sermons, but they're parallel sermons. And notice what he says in Luke chapter 6, verses 33 through 35. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. You know, anybody that's very shrewd, I'll use the word shrewdness rather than wise, although both words might apply. Anybody who's shrewd, if you're working for somebody, you know, if I can do him a favor every once in a while, that gets me on his good side. And so he might do something in return for me. I might be the first one to get a promotion, or I might get a raise, or at least I won't get fired if he's, or laid off if he's laying others off. And so I'll do. See, that's not doing good for the sake of doing good. That's doing good to receive something in return. There's no credit to that. Sinners out in the world know how to play that game, don't they? And they'll play that game with the best of us. All right. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. Why, you go to a sinner out in the world, get a loan, and if he thinks that you might be able to do him a favor on down the line, you know, he says, well, that's some credit I've built up. And so he might be willing to give you something or make you a loan, but he's saying, well, you know, later on if I come back and I want some help, then I expect that back. Sinners out in the world play that game. There's nothing good about that. That's just having the shrewdness to know how to play the game to stay in people's good favor. That's not benevolence. But now what does Jesus say for us to do? Love your enemies. Do good and lend. Now, when we use the word lend, and I had a problem with this for years in Luke 6, we think of a loan that is to be repaid. And remember the Jewish law behind this. Jesus is speaking to Jews at a time when the law of Moses is still in effect, that they could loan to a Gentile and get whatever interest the market would bear, and that was fine. But if they loaned to another Jew, then they could only expect to get their money back with no interest. And by the way, Jews still do that, and the result is they're very shrewd. They do great in business because they get a free loan to start with. They have to pay back the principal, but there's no interest on the principal if they get it from another Jew who's a practicing Jew. And there's nothing wrong with that. I didn't say that to put down Jews. There's nothing at all wrong with that. That is the fulfillment of the law of Moses, but that's not benevolence. But rather, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great. You mean you get high interest? No, but see, that misses the point entirely. The reward is from God, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He is kind to the unthankful and the evil. And thus, if we are going to help as a benevolent act, an act of charity, an act of love, those who are less fortunate, we should expect nothing whatsoever materially in return. Now, by the way, it's wonderful. It's showing that we care for each other when someone says, you know, and there was a couple like this in northern New York. They were babes in Christ. They didn't know any better. That if Sandy and I had them over for dinner, then I'd go, oh, all right, now you've had me over, so next time I have to have you over. So you had to have this swap and swap. Well, that's fine that you like each other, you love each other, you want to visit each other, but that's not charity. But if you have somebody into your home or take them to a restaurant to eat, and you know full well that person can never repay this, and don't expect anything in return, but just do it out of the love of your heart, then that's benevolence, that's charity. That's an act of love which God takes notice of. We should help even our enemies. And this is something that is different from what the church can do. Let's first get the verse. And this is a part of the Sermon on the Mount that we talked about earlier. And by the way, this is leading up to the passage after Jesus has shown some ways that we are to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Then He said in verse 48, you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And we will have a character that is a reflection of the moral nature of God if we do these things. And this is leading right up to this love that we show even for our enemies. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Now, first of all, I want us to see that this is something we have to apply. And then secondly, I want us to see that this shows a distinction between what we must do as individuals and what the local church is allowed to do. Just suppose that I had a Muslim imam, that's a Muslim teacher, living next door to me. And I knew that he probably hated my guts and would like to see me dead because I'm trying to get people to become Christians, and if I have any chance whatsoever, I will convert somebody from Islam to become a disciple of Christ. And that's the truth of the matter. Because I don't believe anybody can be saved in the Muslim religion. And I believe that they need to be led to Christ to be saved. And I believe that's showing love for them to try to get them to do that. So that imam living, and I would plainly tell him that. So that imam living next door to me, if that were to be the case, would probably just hate me and like to see me dead. And if he could get away with it, would do whatever he could to see that I was dead. And would feel justified in doing it. Now, that's my enemy, right? That man wants me dead. That man, if he could get away, do anything to kill me. What should I do to him in return? What if I find out that, you know, that fella is just, he can't feed his family. They don't have food to go put on the table. Should I get Sandra to prepare some food? She does a better job than I do. And take that food next door and say, you know, here's food for you and your family. Should I do? Yes, I should. That's my obligation to him. And I'm showing my love for him. Now here's a question. Does that mean that the church, the local congregation, can help out a Muslim imam? No, of course not. It doesn't mean that, because that would be an expression of fellowship when the church makes, and this is for a later lesson, when the church makes a contribution from its treasury, that's an expression of fellowship in Christ. So I as an individual, not only can, I should help that Muslim imam out as an expression of my love for him to try to lead him to Christ. But the church cannot help that man. It would be an expression of fellowship. And we should be especially concerned for those who are helpless. Now, I had a nice conversation with a friend over in Evening Shade yesterday afternoon, and he had some observations concerning what they do when a Christian comes to them and is in financial need. And I thought he had made some good observations. And one of the observations is that the first thing they might do is counsel with him. It might be that this person has just simply not done a good job of administering the things, of being a steward of the things that God has given him. He may be just spending more than he takes in, but he doesn't have to. And so this man is a successful businessman who runs his own business. then he might want to counsel with this person about being a good steward. And you know, you don't have to drive the best car on the road if you can settle for something less, particularly if you can't afford that best car on the road. You don't have to have a really nice place to live. You can settle for something else. You don't have to go out to Colton's and eat steak. You can settle for something less if you can't afford that. Don't take on bills that you cannot afford if you can get by without that. And so it might be just some counseling. But there are some people that simply don't have the ability to make a living. And that's the ones that we ought to be especially concerned with. And this is what James talks about. And this is in a context. Now I exhort you, without my taking the time in this lesson to do this, read on your own verses 19 through 27. That's the entire context of the passage. And everything in it, every verse in it, is directed to the individual. There's not one verse that's directed to the local church as a collective group, as a group. It's directed to the individual Christian. And it says, pure and undefiled religion. Now, that word religion is an interesting word. It's not used very many times in the Bible, very few times ever used in the Bible. And it means faith in practice, or practical faith. And James, of all the books of the New Testament, emphasizes this matter of faith in practice. You know, there's faith in works. You're not saved by faith alone. It's by working faith. And that's religion. It's faith in practice. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this. It has two components. To visit orphans and widows. Now there are, that's two groups of people that are helpless, that cannot help themselves. An orphan, a dependent child who has no parents to take care of them. Widows in ancient society had nobody. One of the most pathetic scenes that Jesus encountered was the widow who had lost her only son. She had no means by which to make a living because she was dependent on either her husband or her son caring for her. And they were both dead. She was without any means whatsoever of having the necessities of life. And the point, so these two groups have in common is they're in a helpless situation. They depend on somebody else to help them. And rightfully so. To visit orphans and widows in their trouble, as the old King James says, affliction. I like that old King James word, affliction. And to keep oneself unspotted from the world. James' point of all of this is that faith, to be beneficial, must be a working faith. That's what religion is. But he gives two examples, and that's what they are, is examples of pure and undefiled religion. It's doing good for those who are helpless and keeping ourselves from practicing sin. So we've seen now, I'm about to miss one. It must not be done to be seen by men. I had an aunt, and I'll hit this quickly because we're about out of time. Bless her heart. She was very good-hearted. She helped lots of folks, but she wanted as many people as could to know about it. She almost advertised the fact that she'd helped somebody out. And so I didn't want her to help me. It was embarrassing because I knew that everybody in the country knew that I got helped out. You understand? But bless her heart, she helped a lot of people, but everybody knew who she helped. Well, that's not the way we're to be. Matthew chapter 6, and we'll go through this quickly, verses 1 through 4. This is a part of the Sermon on the Mount. Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. You see, that's the point. It's the reason that we do it. It's the motive. Is it to be seen by men? Is it so men will praise us? Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not... Can you imagine this? But apparently it was done by the ancient Jews. Do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets. So Jesus said they do it, therefore they did it. Can you imagine somebody walking before him with a trumpet saying, he's about to give to the synagogue. Come see this great charitable deed this man's going to do. And that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. The point is, they've got the only reward they ever have. Why did they do it? To be seen by men. To have men praise them. So what do they have? They've been seen by men. Men have praised them. What more reward do they have? None. That's all the reward they will receive. It's the reward they saw. It's the reward they will receive. But when you do a charitable deed, Do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. It's kind of hard to hide from your left hand what your right hand is doing, isn't it? That's, of course, a proverbial statement to say, just don't let other folks know about it. Don't do it for the purpose of being seen by men, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. We're all going to stand before the Lord Jesus Christ in judgment one day, and we're going to receive one of two rewards or sentences. We're going to be on one side or the other. We're going to either be with the goats, or we're going to be with the sheep. If we are with the sheep, then the King will say to those, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. But if we have failed to practice benevolence toward the needy in the way that the Lord teaches us to do, then we'll be among those goats. We'll hear these terrible words, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. I want to be among those sheep, and I know that you do also. Number 278. Go ahead and open your songbooks now, please, to number 278.